sake began with a grain of rice. Scotch emerged from barley, tequila from agave, rum from sugarcane, bourbon from corn. Thirsty yet? Today on The Zesty Garden, Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, talks about the plants that create the world's drinks. Of all the extraordinary and obscure plants that have been fermented and distilled, a few are dangerous, some are downright bizarre, and one is as ancient as dinosaurs. The book is a concoction of biology, chemistry, history, etymology, and mixology, and Ms. Stewart will be live and can take your questions or comments. In our Petals and Prose segment, we hear from Logan resident Helen Cannon, and in our first installment of Take a Hike, botanist and hiker David Wallace will tell us about an easy hike to see the seldom-seen flower, the blue camas, up the right-hand fork in Logan Canyon in the Little Cottonwood Drainage, just east of Camp LaMaya. That's all today on The Zesty Garden. Please stay with us. The news is next. Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today we've got quite a range of topics. But first up, something that I received a book in the mail several weeks back, and I thought I just couldn't resist. It's called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. It's by Amy Stewart. Amy is an author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world. She's the co-founder of the blog Garden Rant and is a contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. She and her husband live in Eureka, California, where they own an antiquarian bookstore. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, first, I've just got to ask, how does one start thinking about writing a book about plants and alcohol?
Well, first you go to a bar. This actually is one of those books that began as an idea in a bar. I was talking with a friend of mine about gin, and he said, yeah, I'm not much of a gin drinker. And I said, how can you be interested in plants? Because he's like a landscape designer and a writer. I said, how can you be interested in plants and not be fascinated by gin and all the plants that gin contains? And, you know, from there, we start looking at all the other plants and all the bottles on the shelf. And it's like, you know, really, you walk into a bar and it is nothing but liquefied plants in bottles. That's all it is.
I love that. Now, I have to admit right up front, I'm not an imbiber. But when I read the book, just the history, the etymology, I mean, all of it just comes together in a great way. And I thought this would be just a really good interview. So tell me, what is your background? How do you come about your plant background?
Well, I'm a writer first, and I'm lucky that I get to write about the things that are interesting to me. And one book has sort of led to the next. You know, I got curious about earthworms, and no one had written a book that answered the questions I had, so I went around and interviewed earthworm scientists and wrote a book on earthworms. So in every case, I'm approaching it as a journalist. I'm not a botanist, but I go and interview botanists. And in this case, I also got to interview some distillers and some bartenders as well. So it was quite a diverse cast of characters.
So I can imagine, yeah, in your mind, when you walk into a liquor store, that you're not just looking at it as alcohol. You're thinking about it as everything else that goes into it.
That's right. You know, it looks more like a greenhouse when you think about all the different plants that are in all those bottles. I mean, some people think that most spirits and liqueurs are chemicals or that they're synthetic. And this is the big revelation, is that apart from the really cheap stuff, which, you know, who wants to drink that anyway, it's actually all straight plant matter. You go to a distillery and there are big barrels of dried plants. It's surprisingly all natural, considering what it is.
Well, and the whole process of creating alcohol, I had never even thought to look at it. And I had no idea. I've wondered about, okay, well, where does bourbon come from? And where do you get tequila and so forth? And the book answers all of those questions and much more. So I want to look into the alchemical processes of fermentation and distillation and see if you can address some of the different plants. For instance, the first one I opened up, and it's in the book, this is done in alphabetical order as far as the plants, is agave.
Right.
This was probably my favorite chapter because it goes into the agave plant, how long it's been around, and I looked at how the agave is produced. And, well, you tell the story because you'll do it much better than I can.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying it's your favorite chapter. That chapter took me 6 weeks to write, and at the end of it, I thought, this book is going to take 20 years if I keep this up. I've got to find a way to, but I did. I got so interested in the story that I did all kinds of crazy research. And agave is one of the trickier plants to ferment and distill. So this is a plant. It's a spiky, some people call them century plants. I'm sure you know what they look like.
But they bloom, they're not every century do they bloom, and they're more like every, what, 10 years?
Every 10 to 12 years, depending on the species, yeah. And the way it gets made into tequila is such an incredibly complex process that really took hundreds, if not thousands, of years to work out. They actually chop the sort of the leaves off so that all you end up with is the heart, which they call the piña. And it does look a little like a pineapple or maybe an artichoke. And that gets roasted, and the roasting process takes these really complex starchy molecules and breaks them down into sugars, a lot like caramelizing onions or even like roasting meat. There's actually sweet flavors that happen when you roast meat or toast bread. And so all of that, those sugars get released. And then it gets crushed up and with some water and fed to yeast. And this is the crucial and really ancient part of this process, is that yeast are everywhere, right? I mean, they're floating in the air. There's yeast on you right now. There's yeast on me right now. They're everywhere. And so if you have a vat of sugary solution, yeast are going to naturally find their way there, even if you don't add them. And they go to work eating sugar, and their waste products are ethyl alcohol and carbon dioxide, which is the bubbles, along with a few other things, but I'm oversimplifying a little bit.
So when you're drinking alcohol, you're drinking a waste product of yeast.
That's right. Yes, I know that must sound delightful, but it is true. So anyway, once that happens, you get this kind of low alcohol solution, and then basically to distill it, all you're really doing is boiling it. So if you think about at home, if you've got soup boiling on the stove and a little bit of liquid collects in the lid of the pan, right?
Mm-hmm.
That steam, and it rises up and it condenses on the lid of the pan and turns back into liquid when it hits something that it can condense against. That's all a still really does, is it boils and the alcohol rises up at a certain boiling point, and so they collect that in a condenser and that's the alcohol.
So you can produce lower levels of alcohol without distilling. You just can't get higher concentrations without going through the distillation process?
Yeah, so if you think about it, you know, distillation wasn't really invented or understood until about 800 AD. So until then, no one on the planet had ever had a stiff drink. It was beer and wine, and that was it.
So with agave, pulque was what was first produced. Why don't you talk about the story of how that came about? And I especially liked you referred to a botanist, Eric Carlin, who pioneered coprolite analysis.
Yes, right. So this is so pulque is a mildly fermented drink that could be compared to beer, and it's actually made in a different way. In order to make pulque, what they have to do is scrape out the innards of the plant while it's still alive, with its roots still in the ground. They scrape away at the agave heart and force it to produce a bunch of sap, which is really what it's doing in response to stress. It's trying to heal this wound, much in the way that aloe vera releases sap when you break it off.
Kind of like a sugar maple?
Yeah, or okay. Like sugar maple releases all this resin. So all this sap starts gushing out, and they siphon it off and ferment that, and that's pulque. And this is an ancient drink that was being made long before the Spaniards arrived in Mexico to see them doing it. And the way that we know it's so ancient is not just cave paintings and other things like that, but actual scientific analysis, including this guy, Eric Callan, who was an archaeologist who specialized in, as you said, coprolite analysis. And what that means is, if you can imagine at an archaeological dig where they're finding remains of a human civilization, you also find human waste, believe it or not. So fossilized human waste. And he specializes in analyzing that to figure out what people were eating. And he actually found that he could rehydrate 2,000-year-old coprolite specimens and tell by the smell that they were drinking a lot of pulque. That's how strong this stuff must have been.
Hi, Amy, are you back?
I'm here.
I'm sorry, the vagaries of live radio. Oh, my gosh. Well, I this story about how that came about. So you were just finishing up, and they were doing the analysis?
Right, right. So so when archaeologists analyzed these fossilized human waste products, shall we call them, they were actually able to rehydrate them and just tell from the smell that it was contained high levels of pulque or agave beer.
And they either have really sensitive noses or there's just a really strong smell coming from that.
I know. You have to feel sorry for the poor graduate students who had to work in that lab with that guy, right? Like,
right.
Really? That's your job? But
so when it gets
science.
When agave is distilled, then it becomes, I guess depending on the particular plant variety, then it becomes mezcal or tequila?
That's right, yeah. Originally, all spirits made from agave plants were called mezcal. That was sort of the Indian word for it. And over time, it got to be a little more refined, so that tequila came from an area around Jalisco, and what we now call mezcal comes from an area around Oaxaca. And there's even a few other spirits. There's one called sotol and one called bacanora. All these different spirits come from different regions in Mexico, and they have denominated areas, kind of like the Champagne region of France, and they use different species of the plant, and they process it in a different way, so the flavors are a little different.
So a question I've had all through the book was, how does someone, and in the case of agave, decide that, oh, I'm going to scrape out the middle of this plant and see what sap comes out and then see if I can get alcohol from it?
Yeah, you really do wonder that, don't you? Like, who was the first person to try any of this stuff? And I figure it just has to be a lot of human experimentation. And, you know, remember that in the early days of human civilization, that's all we were doing, right? That was all day, every day, full time, was kind of interacting with the land and figuring out how to get food, and in this case, figuring out how to get drink out of it. So I guess there was plenty of time to try a lot of things and see what worked.
Well, and sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, and when you look at in the 1700s in this country, water was not something that people would drink, and so they're coming up with something else to drink, and so you've got apples, and it coming up with mead.
That's right, yeah, sure. Apples are, were always used to make cider, which is just a very low alcohol, fermented apple juice, and using honey to make mead, and using tree sap, like you mentioned, to make sort of a low-grade wine out of sweet tree sap. Water was not very safe to drink. And it's easy to think back to kind of the 1700s and 1800s and imagine how polluted the Thames River might have been, for instance. But even for early humans, I mean, if you're drinking out of a river or a pond and, you know, a water buffalo dies and falls into that river, it's not very safe to drink, right? And even when we didn't understand microbiology, we still understood that sometimes the water wasn't good. And even if something's just very low in alcohol, it has enough to kill off some bacteria and make for a safer drink.
So what, you know, even the children were drinking this. So what percentage of alcohol are you looking at? I mean, it's very low percentage, I'm sure.
Very low, sure. I mean, a homemade cider might only be 3 or 4% alcohol. That's what's easy to make kind of naturally without really employing a lot of high-tech knowledge to it.
And so, I found it interesting that what the rest of the world calls cider, it's not the same as it is in this country.
Yeah. Americans are different in that way. We call apple juice, we call that cider, particularly if it's cloudy apple juice. But in other parts of the world, really everywhere else in the world, cider means a mildly fermented drink, which is really wonderful. It's bubbly and it's tart, and it's a lovely thing to drink on a summer day. But it's not something that's as well known here in the U.S.
Well, I wanted to back up to agave because there was one thing I did want to ask. As far as the particular variety of agave that is supposed to make tequila, what happens when that plant is being cultivated and you're getting a monoculture of this plant? You're not getting what nature would intend, that genetic diversity.
Yeah, that's become the big problem, is that by law, tequila can only be made from this particular species, Agave tequilana. And the problem with that is that they do tissue culture. So they're propagating them in a laboratory with little bits of tissue, or just taking offshoots from 1 year and creating new plants with those. So they don't get a chance to breed. You know, we said at the beginning that it can take 10 or 12 years for one of these plants to bloom. So for them to breed in the wild takes a long time. You really have to be committed to that and allowing that genetic diversity to happen. So they're getting prone to diseases, and because they can't breed to, you know, breed for more disease-resistant varieties, it is becoming a real problem. You start using more chemicals instead of more organic ways of farming. So it's an issue they're dealing with. Water use is also a big deal. Of course, it's Mexico. It's the desert. And so so water has become a real issue.
On page 8, the third paragraph, I like what you wrote here. You said, over the last few centuries and until the last decade or so, agave-based spirits were considered to be rough products that in no way compared to a good scotch or cognac. And in 1897, a Scientific American reporter wrote that mezcal is described as tasting like a mixture of gasoline, gin, and electricity. Tequila is even worse and is said to incite murder, riot, and revolution.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful for a cocktail, isn't it?
Well, and looking at the different, you have recipes in here as well for creating a cocktail.
That's right, yeah. You know, the subtitle of the book is The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. So these are really classic drinks that people might already know how to make, but my goal was to say, for each of the plants that I write about, what is the best expression of that plant in the glass? So if we're talking about corn, that's obviously going to be bourbon, and I think an old-fashioned is the best cocktail, makes the best use of bourbon. So so they're pretty standard drinks, but what I try to do is really explain what's in them. I mean, even an ordinary cocktail like a Manhattan has at least 20 plants in it, and I think most people don't realize that.
So 20 plants. What plants are in that?
Well, let's see. So in a Manhattan, you've got the bourbon, which is going to have corn and barley and a little rye or wheat. And you could count the oak tree as well, because bourbon is aged in oak, and a lot of oak gets in the spirit. So I think that the oak tree counts as well. The vermouth is made of wine and also has a variety of citrus peel, herbs, and spices in it. So there could be easily a dozen plants in that. And there's a dash of Angostura bitters, and bitters also, you know, easily contain a dozen or so different ingredients, different plants. And then there's the cherry, right? So there's one more. So it's pretty easy to get to 20 that way.
Now, before I leave agave, I do have to ask, usually the movies and so forth, I've always seen tequila with a worm in it. But apparently that's used to cover up bad tequila.
Yeah, well, the law in Mexico now is that you can't put anything in it but the drink. So the only spirit that you could put a worm in now is mezcal. And not everybody does it. Not all mezcal contains it. And it's sort of a gimmicky, touristy thing to do. And it's really looked down upon by the really fine, high-end mezcal makers who wish that it would be outlawed so as not to give their product such a bad name. But what it is the larva of the agave snout weevil, which is a pest to the agave plants. And if you do buy a bottle that's got the worm in it, I should tell you that studies have been done that show that a little worm DNA is evenly distributed throughout the bottle. So even if you don't drink the worm, there is a little worm in every sip.
but typically, those are in mezcal. That's just not going. It's not good. It's not a good product. It's.
It's usually not the good stuff. It's a gimmicky thing, and the people who are making the good stuff don't bother with it.
Well, I wanted to go a little bit in depth then into what you call the oldest living organism.
Ah, yeast.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, because I'm thinking if you're making this product and there's yeast floating all around. I mean, there are different strains of yeast, so you could have a different flavor depending on which yeast happens to cultivate what you're creating.
You could. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the way yeast gets to be our oldest domesticated organism is by accident. You know, the yeast that that do best for wine, for turning wine sugars into good wine, are not naturally found on grapevines. They're naturally found on oak trees. And the best guess is that what was happening was that either grapevines were climbing up oak trees, and so when the grapes were harvested, this yeast was nearby, or that maybe people were harvesting acorns from oak trees and grapes at about the same time using the same baskets, and so that yeast just got integrated into winemaking equipment. But that's how these different strains come about, is that they live on the equipment. They live in the barn or the distillery facility. A lot of distillers are very superstitious about their strains of yeast and don't want to move their facilities because they think it would disrupt the invisible microbial community that is that gives them their particular flavor.
Now, the whole idea behind creating alcohol is that this yeast is feeding on sugar. So
right.
When you look at beer and barley, you know, any kind of a grass plant, they're not going to store a lot of sugar. They've got more starch. So how does that process work so that that starch changes to sugar so that the yeast can feed on it?
What I love is, like, the more you know about plants, the more you just already understand this stuff. So barley is a seed, of course, right? And so is wheat and so is corn. These are the seeds for the next generation. And so what the plant does is plants make a lot of sugar. Plants make sugar all the time, and they make it for all kinds of reasons. And so what they do with their seeds is they take a little bit of sugar and they store it inside that grain in the form of starch so that it'll last longer. If they just left it as sugar, then it would rot the way fruit might rot on the vine. So they store it in the form of starch, and then when the seed gets wet, which is a signal that it's time to start germinating, it starts putting out little root and a little leaf, and enzymes inside the seed start busting that starch back into sugar so that the little plant has something to eat until it's big enough to make its own food. So barley, in particular, is very high in those enzymes that break starch into sugar. And that's why there's a little barley in all kinds of beer and grain spirits, because once it's done turning its own starch into sugar, it'll go to work on the wheat and the corn and the rye and whatever else is in there.
And that's also thrown in with, like, if you're trying to create a mash from wheat, I mean, that barley concoction can be thrown into there and help that process along.
Help it along, exactly right. Yeah, and that's called malting, by the way. So you hear the phrase malted barley. That's just barley that's been gotten wet so that the seeds will germinate.
Well, let's talk about that process and what exactly is happening with that. Because I had no idea. Like, again, I'm not an imbiber, but it's like, really, you have these different alcohols. Scotch. It's where scotch comes from.
Right. So scotch is a particularly interesting one because if you go to Scotland, you can actually see this process at work in the distilleries that still do it the old-fashioned way. So they will actually get a truckload of barley, get it wet, and it starts germinating, so it looks kind of like bean sprouts, you know, with the little tiny root coming out and a little tiny leaf coming out. And they spread that on the floor of their malting house, and they want to stop that process. They obviously don't want a room full of young growing barley plants, right? They just want these little tiny seeds that have only just begun that process, so the sugar has just been released. And as soon as that happens, they want to stop the process. So how do you do that? Well, you dry it out. So they run smoke through the malting house, and that dries it out and stops the little plants from growing. And that smoke is from a peat fire. And so that's where that peaty fragrance comes from, is they're burning peat for that.
Which is why when you think of scotch, you think of it coming from Scotland, because it's a great place for those bogs.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and that wonderful smoky flavor is literally smoke. That is, you know. Now a lot of modern scotch makers buy their malted barley from a malting house, and they can specify the level of peat. So it's done in a more industrial way, which in a way is good because we don't want to deplete the peat bogs, so they can use minimal amounts of peat in a much more efficient way. But it is kind of neat to go see them doing it the old-fashioned way, where they're just literally permeating the place with peat smoke.
Now, you have a page on here about the best way to drink whiskey, and I thought this was really interesting. Just adding a little bit of water makes it taste better. How does that work?
Yeah, that's right. Don't ever be a purist and drink things without water. It turns out that when you add a little bit of water or an ice cube into any kind of high-proof spirit or liqueur, what happens is that some of these fatty, oily, flavorful molecules that actually come from the plants are unstable in the presence of water. They break out of suspension and clump together. So a good way to imagine this is if you, let's say you have some soup that's got a little olive oil or butter in it, and you know how that can kind of glob together on the surface of the soup?
Mm-hmm.
It's, if you've seen that happen, it's the same idea, only on a much smaller level. So once those oily molecules clump together, you can taste them more. You can actually experience them better. So alcohol with a little bit of water added actually tastes better and stronger, not weaker. So you're not diluting it. It's the same reason why cocktails are shaken over ice. You know, some people store their gin or vodka in the freezer. You don't need to do that. Keep it at room temperature and let a little bit of ice melt in the cocktail shaker. That is actually improving the flavor.
So why should it be shaken and not stirred?
You know, I think this is a silly debate, and I tend to kind of shake everything. I don't think that there's all that much of a difference, and some people are horrified to hear me say this. They talk about, oh, you could bruise the gin or you could bruise the wine, but I have yet to see any evidence of any bruising going on.
We've just seen too many James Bond movies.
Right, yeah. But some people say that if it's got juice or wine or something like that in it, you should stir it rather than shake it. And I tend to do whatever's the most expedient for me, and I think it works out fine either way. The only exception is if there's an egg white in there or something else that really has to be made to foam, then you have to give it a good long shake to make that happen.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest today is Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can send us a tweet at #zestygarden. I wanted to look at some of the different plants. Specifically, monkey puzzle. I remember when I lived in the Portland area 30 years ago, I saw this tree and I thought, this is the most bizarre looking tree I've ever seen. And it's the monkey puzzle. And that's been around since dinosaur times. And it's one that is used to create some alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. I think the monkey puzzle tree may be the oldest tree in the world from which alcohol is made. It's a conifer that's been around for 160 million years at least. And and as a conifer, it produces kind of like pine cones, right? These big cones, and there are seeds in there. I mean, if you've ever had pine nuts, then you know that, you know, some conifers produce these little oily seeds. So in Chile, where this plant is native, native people will make a homemade beer from those monkey puzzle nuts. And the way they do it is that they chew the nuts a little bit so that the enzymes that are always in human saliva help start that process of breaking the starches down into sugars and starting the fermentation process. So actually chew them a little bit and then spit them out into a kind of a shared vat. And everyone does this until there's enough there that it can start fermenting on its own.
And that's not, that's not the only plant that's happened with.
Right. That's actually a typical thing to do in South America. There are a lot of, so the monkey puzzle in particular, they call that mudai, but there are a lot of homemade beers called chicha, some of them made with corn, and really a lot of things. A lot of different plants get made into something called chicha, where they do the same thing. They chew it first and then spit it into this tub.
So it's the enzymes in the saliva?
Right, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it is interesting that there's so much going on in saliva to break down plant matter that is similar to what happens when you make alcohol. It's really the same process that our bodies are just equipped to do.
Well, this is a fascinating book, and I appreciate you taking the time to come and join us.
Well, thank you. This was fun.
You've been listening to Amy Stewart. She's author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. She is an author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world. She is the co-founder of the popular blog Garden Rant and is a contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. She lives in Eureka, California, and owns an antiquarian bookstore called Eureka Books. Amy, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the program, we're going to take a quick break and then come back with our next Petals and Prose segment. Helen Cannon, a former teacher of English at USU and a lover of literature and gardening and who resides in Logan, is giving our next segment on Petals and Prose. So stay tuned.
Hey there, this is Matt Jensen, reporter and afternoon host at Utah Public Radio. One of my favorite ways to shop is through online auctions. I'm one of those bidders that sneaks in at the last minute and grabs the best deals like an internet ninja. Well, that was Miss Piggy, but you get the idea. UPR's 60th anniversary online auction is going on right now. Bid on things like bed and breakfast getaways, Utah dining, fine art, and more. Don't let these great deals slip away. And when you bid, you support public broadcasting on Utah Public Radio. So go to upr.org and click on the online auction link to find hundreds of great items at awesome prices. But don't let an online ninja find them before you do.
I've known for a long time that gardeners often are also men and women of literature. And I have a huge collection of books by literary people about their gardens. And so I intend to read small segments from my library, occasionally descending into my own writing about gardens. And I'm beginning with a piece, an introduction by E.B. White, who you will know as the author of Charlotte's Web, Stuart Little, but also he set the tone for the New Yorker talk pieces, the casual, urbane tone that I think the New Yorker editor wanted everyone to sound like occasionally. He married his editor, Catherine White. She was a marvelous editor at the New Yorker, and she was also a gardener. And so at some point in her life, she decided to start writing about gardens. And she called her garden pieces Onward and Upward in the Garden. E.B. White adored Catherine, and you'll easily see that in his introduction to her garden pieces. It was Catherine's invention, however, and proved a happy choice for her adventure in garden writing. After 2 years of giving the catalogs an annual going over and assessing the prose style and idiosyncrasies of writers, she set to work Onward and Upward, exploring other aspects of the garden world, the history of gardens, the literature of gardens, the arranging of flowers, the herbalists, the trends and developments. She was blessed with a curious mind, and she ranged widely. She continually revealed her own prejudices, her likes and dislikes, her crotches. Catherine was a traditionalist, not only in gardens, but everywhere else. She preferred the simple to the ornate, the plain to the fancy, the relaxed to the formal, the single to the double, the medium-sized to the giant. She detested abbreviations, snaps, mums, glads, dells. She did not care for flowers that to her eye were gross or pretentious or stiff. And I'll start here. One of the minor amusements I enjoyed for some 40 years was watching my wife fix flowers, an operation that in our home in Maine usually took place in a few minutes before lunch. Newspapers would be spread out on a round yellow table on the north porch, our summer dining room. Vases would be set out, and Catherine would arrive fresh from the cutting garden, bearing baskets of assorted blooms, maybe 75 flowers in all, from which 4 or 5 arrangements would be built. She had picked flowers not at random, but with an uncanny accuracy. The right kinds, the right length of stems, the right colors to fulfill exactly some deep mental image she had of the final results. She never hesitated. She never fussed. She was quite rough with flowers, as if to say, if you can't take the heat, go away somewhere and wilt. She worked quickly, deftly, and seemingly without plan. This last was not true. Her head was full of blueprints, images of the finished bouquets, and she worked in bold strokes to achieve them. A style, I'm sure, would have been amazed by the judges of the National Council. Sometimes, as I sat quietly in my corner watching her throw flowers at each other, it looked as though she were playing darts in an English pub. Whenever I could, I attended these flower arranging sessions. They lasted only 10 or 15 minutes because it was a little like going to a magic show. She seldom spoke during the show, seldom commented on the finished product. Once in a while, she would make a pronouncement, sotto voce, there, that's pretty. But there was always the hint of question mark buried there. Is it? Is it pretty? As the years went by and age overtook her, there was something comical yet touching in her bedraggled appearance, the small, hunched-over figure, her studied absorption in the implausible notion that there would be yet another spring. Oblivious to the ending of her own days, which she knew perfectly well was near at hand, sitting there with her detailed chart under those dark skies in the dying October, calmly plotting the resurrection. This ends E.B. White's introduction to Catherine White's Onward and Upward in the Garden. I look forward to reading others of her essays and other garden essays from other writers. Until next time, then, this is Helen Cannon.
Welcome back to this portion of the program. I have an additional guest today, and Grant Cardin is in studio. He's USU's Extension Soil Specialist, and we're going to talk a little bit about composting right now. So, Grant, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I was going through my garden, and I did some tilling. I've been doing a lot of weeding, and I had bags of leaves that were on my carrots all winter long, so I've thrown those. I'm a lazy composter. I just throw them into a pile. It may take a couple of years, but eventually have this wonderful amendment that I can use to put into the soil in my flowers. But I was pulling weeds on Monday, and my wife asked, why aren't those in the compost pile? And they're far enough along that I'm just afraid there's enough moisture left in the weeds that those seeds are going to keep going.
They can keep going.
And then they're
going
to be in my compost pile, and I'm putting weeds back in the soil.
Yeah, that's one of the questions we get all the time about, you know, can I put weeds in my compost? And I tend to say, you know, if it's just real vegetative, it hasn't gone to flower or anything like that, then you're probably all right. But if it goes to flower, they get pretty aggressive at trying to finish that seed off if they can. And even if they're, you know, been recently uprooted. So, yeah, anything that also would propagate vegetatively, meaning that, you know, a stem or a root or something like that would give rise to another plant, you don't want to put that in your compost either. Things like bindweed or crabgrass or some of these others that, even though they're not flowering, they can root and begin to grow in your compost pile on their own. So
in the next 8.5 minutes, let's talk then about the different plants that people would have in their yard, what can be thrown into the compost pile, what shouldn't be thrown into it, and then how to get it going. Earlier this year, when I was opening up, I had some grass out in the garden, and I had a pile of it, and I pulled the neighbor kid over and said, stick your hand in this, and he stuck it in, and he pulled it right out. He said, that's hot.
It is hot. Yeah.
I says, well, that's composting.
I think it's one of the probably most underutilized resources we have in our yards. We, a lot of times, you know, we clean it all up, bag it up, ship it off, you know, to the dump or something else, and we can make use of it for the value that it has, not only in returning nutrients to the soil, but that important organic matter that, you know, that heat that you're talking about generated, that's the microbes that are chewing on that stuff and breaking it down. Well, they'll do that in the soil too, and it feeds them. And I often teach in my Master Gardener classes that you can't separate the living part from the physical part of the soil. We have to build the living part as well, and that's what that organic matter is really good to do. And so, you know, we want to try to return that back to the soil. So you've got grass clippings, you've got your leaf waste, and you've got your, you know, chippings perhaps from prunings in the garden. Typically around this time of year, you know, the fruit tree prunings that piled up that you might have or other things. All of that can go in. Now, there's a very few exceptions that we see around here, things like black walnut or cedar or some of those other kinds of things that have biocidal or, you know, herbicidal properties, and we don't want to put those in the compost. But typically, most of the things that we have that are plant-based, as long as they're not like we talk about weeds or other things, can be put in there and produce a really wonderful amendment after it breaks down over time.
So avoid any animal products, like, you know, fat that you've cut off your chicken in the
right
in the house.
Things
like
those
that.
Things will decompose as well, and do readily. The problem with those is that any kind of meat protein, dairy protein, any animal fat or protein that's around will potentially smell really bad when it decomposes and draw things to your compost or to your garden that you don't want to have there. Things like rats and bats and snakes and things like that that you just don't want around.
So it's not necessarily bad for the compost. It's just what it attracts to.
Right. And there is some potential problems with crossover pathogens between animals and humans. So we want to try to avoid some of that too. So we don't have that problem with plant-based materials. So kitchen waste that's plant-based, cull vegetables. I often joke that compost piles are a great place to kill unwanted zucchini, you know, because you have a lot of that around. But no, those kinds of things can be used readily. Just avoid anything with animal fats or proteins that can bring pathogens or unwanted guests to your yard.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking how I tell my neighbors, bring your grass clippings over, because I mulch mine. I want that nitrogen from the grass that I mow to go back into the grass. So I never have enough to put out into the garden.
One of the things that I caution people against, though, in that particular case, as long as you know your neighbors and what they're doing with their lawn, that's
yes.
great.
Because I don't want chemicals. Right, if they're spraying their lawn, I don't want to have those chemicals. Or if they're growers of dandelions, I don't want the seeds.
The seeds and things like that. Yeah, so, you know, be careful of that. And in your own garden, make sure that if you have applied any chemical that it's beyond the, you know, the reentry breakdown periods and things like that, the residual effect you don't want to carry over into your material. But one of the things that we find a lot of times this time of year is that we have a lot of excess grass clippings. I mean, our mulch mowers can't keep up with the early spring or fall growth because of those cool season grasses we use. They just go crazy. And so sometimes you have a little extra, you know, that you want to throw in there. Too much of that, which is high in nitrogen, like you said, can cause that material to use up all the oxygen within the pile, and then it gets real smelly. And I noticed that this last week in my compost pile, we'd been putting a lot of grass clippings in it. And it was quite odiferous.
Smelly and yeah. slimy. And
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And that's a balance issue with what we call green and brown materials. Things that are high in carbon would be called brown materials. Things green, would not necessarily their color, but high in nitrogen. So grass clippings are really high in nitrogen. We want to try to mix those with things like leaves or chippings from prunings or things like that that'll help create a balanced diet, as it were, for the microbes that are there.
So leaves, if they were green, would be the green material, but once they've lost their chlorophyll and have died, then they become the carbon material.
Yeah, and you mentioned you had some that were sitting over the tops of your, you know, in your garden over the winter and things like that, covering some of your root crops. So you can use those readily then as brown materials. If you don't have enough brown, which sometimes you don't have, I go down and buy... I have bought bales of white pine shavings, you know, just the stuff you would use in in an animal hutch or something like that. Not the cedar, but the white pine.
The white pine.
And you can mix a couple of armloads of that in with the grass clippings, and that helps solve that problem.
Well, I want to take a quick question. We have Barbara in Hiram. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Hey. I just have a curiosity question. I love to have my eggshells in my compost, but I'm wondering, do they ever really break down? Because I can see every place I've ever put compost that has eggshells.
Yeah.
I like it for my tomatoes, but does it really break down, or is it going to be there forever and ever?
Well, eggshells, that comes through an organic machine, the chicken, but they're not organic. They're mineral. They're like bone. They're calcium carbonate
right.
or lime. And so they'll dissolve slowly or break down physically over time, but they're not like organic matter that is then decomposable. But
right.
So you'll it's like having a little piece of rock. You know, in your and it helps a lot sometimes when you add that as it breaks up to add some material that'll keep the soil loose. If you've got problems with clay materials and things like that, it'll help keep that
so
broken
over,
up a little
over
bit.
Over time, they really do leach out in some way. Then,
they'll slowly dissolve. Calcium carbonate's not real soluble, and we have lots of it in our soil already. So if you want to add eggshells to keep it kind of loose and broken up like you would, say, with perlite or something else in a potting mix, then that's fine. But they're not organic material.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks, Barbara.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we've reached the end of our time already.
Oh, that's all right. Well, I'm always willing to talk about
this.
I will
have you back because there's plenty to talk about.
Great.
You've been listening to Grant Cardin. He's USU's Extension Soil Specialist. And before we finish the program, we have a segment on Take a Hike. It's our first segment. And David Wallace, who is representing the Utah Native Plant Society as well as Cache Hikers, will give us a little bit of where we should go hiking this weekend. This is our first segment of Take a Hike, and I have in studio with me David Wallace. He's representing the Utah Native Plant Society and Cache Hikers. And David, you have a passion for botany and hiking. Where did that come from?
Well, stems clear back from my days in high school, but I majored in botany when I was going to college. That's not been my profession, but I've kept it as a hobby. I've maintained a relationship with the Utah Native Plant Society. I'm a lifetime member and a board member with them. And also hiking. I love the outdoors. I backpack. I get out as much as I can, and the two work very well together.
You've got a flower, and we're going to be doing this over the next little while, having you come in and talk about different hikes and flowers you might see along the way. And coming out or out right now is a particular flower that's of interest because most people wouldn't know to look for it. It's not that common.
The plant that I'm going to talk about today is the blue camas. Now, that's the name of Camas, Utah, so obviously it's been in this area. But I don't see it very much, and I didn't see it very much until I moved up to Logan 15 years ago, and I was delighted to find it in our local mountains.
And so what is a blue camas? I've heard of death camas that I had from a class that I took at Utah State, but I'm not familiar with the blue camas.
Well, the blue camas is a lily, and it has a superficial resemblance to death camas. So the flowers are a little larger, and they're blue. It grows in huge fields in the Northwest, in Idaho and Western Montana, for example, and the Indians use it as an important food product. In fact, they use it to supply Lewis and Clark to help them with some of their travels. In fact, it's so valuable to the Indians in that area that they fought wars over it. But here, it's just it grows occasional spots, and as I mentioned, I was delighted to be able to find it.
So where would you find it?
It grows in wet meadows, the areas that had to be wet during the spring. And here, the place I want to talk about is in Logan Canyon in the right-hand fork up a little trail called the Cottonwood Trail. The Little Cottonwood Trail, I have to clarify that. There's a regular Cottonwood Trail elsewhere in Logan Canyon. But this Little Cottonwood Trail goes up to after about a mile and a half or so, you encounter a wet meadow. And in early to mid-June, you're likely to find the camas growing there.
And where is this trail located? You said it's the Little Cottonwood Trail. And how do you get there?
Well, if you're familiar with Logan Canyon, you would drive from the Logan side toward Bear Lake. And I didn't check the mileage exactly, but when you get to the right-hand fork, and you may recognize the right-hand fork, there's a house that's actually built right off the side of the road at that location.
So just before you cross the river on your right side, there'll be a road that takes off. And this is before what a lot of people would call the middle portion of the canyon.
Yeah, it's before it climbs up to the higher elevation, before the dugway. You turn right there. It's a paved road for a couple of miles, and you'll get to the old girls' camp, the Camp Lomia. And here, if you took the right-hand fork, you'd end up going over the mountain up Cully Canyon and coming out at Blacksmith Fort Canyon. But instead, take the left-hand fork, and you'll drive perhaps a mile, come to a parking area and a trailhead. Now, most people would continue going east up the right-hand fork towards Old Ephraim's Grave or Steel Hollow or Willow Creek. But what I'd ask you to do is to turn around and go back about 100 yards where there's a corral. And at that corral is the site of the trailhead for the Cottonwood Trail. And if you hike up it, as I mentioned, about a mile and a half, you'll come to a little cottonwood spring and the meadows.
And so how long is this trail if you take the whole trail?
If you just go up and back, you'll be there within a mile and a half. And what I like to do is make a loop. Say either going up the next trail, which is Mon Hollow, and going up to the meadow area above and then coming down through past Little Cottonwood Spring, or reverse the direction. Either one works. And that would be about 5 miles, 5 or 6 miles if you did the whole trip.
If you did the whole thing. But if you just went up to where this blue camas is growing, it's about a mile and a half. What would be the elevation gain for that?
Oh, it will be just a couple hundred feet elevation gain. I think, as I recall, you start around 5,600 feet, and that's probably around 6,000, so maybe 400 feet to that location.
Okay, so not too much an elevation gain, so it wouldn't be that difficult of a hike.
No, but I will warn you, I haven't checked it this year, but it had some water damage in the lower part of the trail. That's technically a motorcycle user trail. And I honestly don't know how they can get up there unless that damage has been fixed. But just be aware of that. Once you get past that portion, it'll be a fine trail.
Anything else that you would see along the trail? Anything, other things to look at?
Well, this is a nice hike because it goes through several different habitats. So you'll see open sagebrush plants below. And this time of year, we might see larkspur, for example, maybe some of the milk vetches, probably see some balsam root. But as you get higher up, it becomes the wet meadow, and you'll see the yellow violets. I know that's a contradiction in terms, but it's another one of my favorite plants, the yellow violets and the blue camas in the wet areas. And if by some chance you're too early for the blue camas, you can go a little higher, and you're likely to see things like the yellow fritillary that I like as well.
And so you'll see the blue camas in the more moist meadows.
Right.
And early June to mid-June,
yes,
approximately.
Yes, as I recall.
How long do these flowers stay out once they open?
They only stay out about a week or two. We have to realize that with our native plants, their job is to do their business and get a life going. The plants we have in our gardens have been selected to maintain the blooms far longer than nature would prefer. So we're in their world when we look at natives.
So with the blue camas, it has a bulb like a tulip. It looks like a small onion bulb.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's about a half an inch in diameter or so. It comes back every year, obviously, from that bulb.
What's the blooming doing then for the flower? Does it actually form seed?
Yeah, it forms seed.
Okay.
My observation, I don't see clusters of them. So I'm just guessing at this, but I'm thinking it probably reproduces mostly by seed rather than by division of the bulb. But that's speculation right now.
And we'll have a map on our website so that people can look to it. We'll also have a link to Cache Hikers because there's some additional descriptions of other hikes and things that are available. But this sounds like a great flower to look for. What color? It's blue, but what color of blue are we looking for?
It's a lighter blue. It's not a deep royal blue, but a sky blue, almost a light sky blue.
And is in this particular area, is it a whole meadow full of them, or is it just one particular section?
The place I'm talking about, there by the Cottonwood Spring, and you'll recognize it, by the way, because it's been dammed up, and there's a little pond there where the spring is. So just uphill from the spring is where the meadows start, and it's widespread throughout there. It could be anywhere in a quarter mile circle there at that point.
Well, thank you very much for coming and doing this. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks, David. To end our program, I've got a couple of calendar items. First, the Logan Ira Society is having their annual show tomorrow and Saturday at the First Presbyterian Church in Logan. And then Cache Hikers is having a hike to Oxford Ridge via Third Creek Trail near Weston. Expect wildflowers and a great view on this excursion to the northwestern edge of Cache Valley. Meet at 8 o'clock a.m. and plan to return at 5. Additional information is at cachehikers.org. And then the Cache chapter of the Utah Native Plant Society is hosting the Richard J. Memorial Wildflower Walk this Tuesday at 6 at the first parking lot up Green Canyon. Thanks for joining us on the Zesty Garden.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.